It is that time of the week again where we bring you the 138th attempt to take Murph and Morgan off the air. We welcome you to Game of Crimes.
Woo-hoo.
I'm here with you, my partner in crime.
Hey, everybody, it's Murph, and no, welcome back.
How do you know it's Murph? How do we know it's really you? All they hear is a voice. They don't see the face, which fortunately, that's fortunate. That's good.
That's because we have faces made for radio.
Well, one of us does.
Yes, you do.
I got my hair going. Anyway, hey, guys, thanks for joining us. Just some quick housekeeping before we get into episode 138 this week. Apple, Spotify, hit those reviews, the 5 stars. You can leave comments on Spotify, and you're going to want to do that on this one. This one is going to be very interesting. You're going to have fun with this. Also, head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. You'll find a lot of pictures from today's episode, along with the book that's going to be there. So we've got our merch list, our gutter book list. Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go to Game of Crimes Fans, type it into that search tool in Facebook, and it'll bring up our page, fan group run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, ruler with the iron fist with the velvet glove. If you don't like it, tough. Just join the group anyway. And subject yourself to the same abuse we do on a daily, almost daily basis where people say stuff about us.
Yeah,
it hurts my feelings.
If they're talking about us, they're leaving someone else alone. So we're okay with it.
That's right. We're good with that. Hey, but do that. But head on over there. That's where we have a lot of fun. But where you got to be? You got to be on Patreon. Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We just got through recording Case of the Month, which is a misnomer because it's Cases of the Month. But Case of the Month sounds better. But we just talked about 4 things. And seriously, some stuff that will just piss you off and stuff that, you know, makes your head scratch. And some lessons too about why, if you're prohibited from owning a firearm, you probably should not be shooting at people after they're fleeing the scene. There's some, interesting stories there, but hey, but we got a lot of stuff over there. We got, 911 coming up, the Narcometer review, which, I think we're going to have fun with this one. This one's going to be good. We go back a little bit in time, but it's from one of the biggest authors in the thriller space and the movie that launched the career of another soon to be famous star that we'll tell you about later. But why the tease? You got to go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and find out what it is we're talking about, right, Murph?
Absolutely. It's I'm out of the doghouse now, so we're picking really, really good movies. They're all law enforcement related, but you know, we'll tell you what we think is true and what's not true, and it ends up just being a lot of fun.
Yeah, we rated on 3 factors, accuracy, authenticity, and believability. We give it a rating of 1 to 10 kilos, 10 being they nailed it, 1 not even in the ballpark.
Yep.
So come find out what we're going to do this month. But anyway, let's talk about this show. Just visit patreon.com/gameofcrimes. But this week, this show is about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but
if you haven't figured it out, we never take ourselves serious, and we're not going to today.
And one of the ways we prove that we don't take ourselves seriously is we reserve a little bit of time during the show to demonstrate that. So guess what time it is, Murph?
I bet it's time for Small Town Police Blotter.
And thank you to Katie Pauly, one of my former colleagues at the police department, who said you and I last week basically got in sync on Small Town Police Blotter. So
well, it's, you know, we can see each other on video, but I don't know if there's a lag or what, but it's
only mentally, Murph. Only mentally.
It's only taken us 3 years to do this, right?
All right. Hey, Murph, real quick.
Yeah.
This happened down at Vero Beach, Florida. Population 16,354.
Salute. Nice place, by the way.
Murph, Popeye's chicken is pretty popular. I mean,
oh, yeah.
You get that, right? You know what else is popular?
What?
Fornicating across the street from Popeye's chicken as everybody's going through the drive-thru and you are on the middle of the frickin' median having sex, and then you are surprised when the cops show up. So, two people, Arnold Mackey, this dude is 70, having sex with the 44-year-old April White. He appeared flustered and was able to fully pull up his shorts, which left his penis fully exposed to oncoming traffic. That is in the report.
You know what? Know,
they went that away.
You never want to see a penis out on the highway, but you certainly don't want to see a 70-year-old one.
Oh, my gosh. Well, apparently he must still be functional plumbing because they were a motorist called 911 after the spotting the duo and said he did a double take because he couldn't believe what he was seeing. And when the cops showed up, he noticed that the 70-year-old was making a thrusting motion while on top of the other suspect.
Oh,
so
geez.
He said it was not his intention to expose himself. Okay.
Well, then why aren't you in a car, in a hotel room, in a bedroom somewhere, anywhere?
Okay, well, they were both arrested for exposure of sexual organs, a misdemeanor. And White, the lady, was also arrested for resisting arrest and disorderly intoxication. Why? Because they found 4 empty vodka bottles along with an unopened bottle of rum next to them.
No, I'm not drunk.
I'm sorry. You can have that much vodka. It's like Milton Berle said. He said, at my age, it's like shooting pool with a rope.
Okay, boom.
Ba-doom, thank you very much. I'll be here all week, folks. All right. Hey, I don't know where this came from, but I found this just doing some research. But I like the little small town research. But they say a deputy, unknown location, went as a convenience store about 11 o'clock at night when he noticed another customer whose pants fell down when the man opened a cooler door. So you're thinking, okay, pull him up. The man pulled up his pants, made a purchase, went out to his truck, and got in. Well, when your pants fall down, that's usually a clue for law enforcement that says, let's check what this guy's doing. So the deputy went over to talk with him. The man said he was having a diabetic issue. He was drinking milk he had purchased at the store, but the deputy noticed the odor of an alcoholic beverage. The man said, I haven't been drinking anything, but he agreed to do a preliminary breath test. Another deputy, you know, arrives to do the backup. Man got out of his truck to talk. He provided his driver's license, and his pants fell down again. He retrieved his pants, and guess what, Murph? A guy who was drinking milk said, I haven't been drinking anything, did the preliminary breath test, and he did some additional breath samples, which registered, the legal limit is 0.08. He registered at 0.168 and 185. So he was arrested. But now I like the newspaper article. The final comment in the newspaper article, there was no report of whether he was given a belt at the detention center. Yeah, don't give belts at the detention center. You take them away. So,
I guess the milk had fermented, which had resulted in him being inebriated.
It still doesn't. It's not alcoholic. Still not going to make it. It'll curdle. All right, last one. Rockdale County, Georgia. Do you know where Rockdale County is?
No, I don't.
All right, well, there's an idiot there who lives there. you might know him. So you know how they use social media now, the sheriff's office, they posted a list of their 10 most wanted violent offenders. They posted it on social media. And, you know, obviously you get comments. Well, one of the comments you don't usually expect to get back is from somebody himself who is wanted. But this time it wasn't the guy that was on the list. The guy goes, hey, what about me? Why wasn't I listed? So the sheriff's office said, you're correct. You've got 2 warrants. We're on the way. So they went over and arrested his ass. And then they posted a picture of him, which is dressed the same as his profile photo. They found him. And he's currently held on 2 charges of felony probation violation. Now, the reason they said, sorry, pal, you didn't make the list, because we normally do it for people wanted for violent crimes like murder, rape. But make no mistake, the people in Rockdale County, they're actively looking for anybody with a warrant. And if you so choose to call up and say, but what about me? Talk about the fear of being left out, of missing out. Why didn't I get a participation ribbon? Here you go, Skippy.
Yeah, come on, Skippy. We got a place for you. And actually, I just looked up Rockdale County, and I've been there numerous times. It's where Conyers is. It's a county just east of Atlanta.
Oh.
Just didn't remember the name of it.
Didn't remember the name.
But that doesn't mean I'm getting old.
No, but that just means there's an idiot there.
It's in jail now.
What about me? Well, okay, here you go. Here's your participation ribbon. It is your booking sheet. Anyway,
idiot.
Let's talk about this week's episode, because this one I tracked down because I saw a tweet and I looked at this, and I'll tell you why it caught my attention, because I learned about this organization. We'll save the name for a second. About a year ago, and I was talking to somebody from the community in the know, and they said, hey, you really should check out this thing called the First Capabilities Integration Group. And as I got to researching it, the reason I'm saying that, it's included in my second book that I'm working on. So my first one's done. I'm actually hoping to get the editorial comments back this week, finish that out. But I'm halfway through book 2, and I'm including this because it has had several names during history. And one of them is one that you were familiar with, Murph, called Centrus Spike.
Yeah, that might be something we worked with when we were in Colombia. It's declassified now, so we can talk about it.
Declassified now, but you, like you said, it was interesting because this group operates under sometimes the title that allows them to operate with CIA as an intelligence mission. So there's Title 10, there's Title 50. So they're able to operate with them. And you were saying too that now that you kind of, we learned about this, you were saying that there was something a little different about some of the equipment or some of the people operating the equipment. They weren't like just traditional CIA, like there might have been some other people down there.
Yeah, there was, and I won't go into too much detail because I'm not sure how much is declassified. But, you know, when we were in Medellin at the police base hunting for Pablo, everybody knows we had SEAL Team 6 with us, and we had the Delta Force guys out of the U.S. Army with us for 18 months. And I just love these guys. I've stayed in touch with some of them and just lifelong friends. But the room that they were relegated to was a relatively small room. And, you know, we're talking probably 8 operators in a small room with your equipment and your, you know, you need a place to sit and a place to eat and all that kind of stuff. But they, after we'd been there for a few months, all of a sudden they hung a curtain halfway back in the room. It was a little bit of a deep room. And they had some equipment arrive that was installed behind the curtain. And then we had a couple guys that would show up and they'd rotate every few months and they would sit literally behind the curtain, you know, and the curtain was there because we didn't want the Columbia National Police officers to come to the door and the door open and they see who's back there and what they're doing. So, you know, I think it was represented mostly as it's just, you know, it's there for privacy. If somebody needs to go back and just have some private time or whatever. But now, was it who we're talking about? It's not about this particular individual that we're about to have on the show today, but makes me wonder if some of the people he worked with weren't sitting behind that curtain.
They were. And so we will reveal. So what I did was I tracked this down, got a hold of one of the co-authors, the person that helped him write the book. The person we're talking about today, Adam Gamal, it's not his real name. In fact, when we had him on, he still is in disguise, backlit. You know, we can't see his face, can't see him. It's called The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. And this thing, they call it the Intelligence Support Activity, the First Capabilities Integration Group, kind of run out of Fort Bragg, where a lot of the, special operators stage out of. You've got everything from the Rangers to, you know, the Airborne, folks like that. But what makes this interesting is that you'll hear his story. We don't want to get into too much of his story, but he comes over from Egypt, didn't speak a lick of English, taught himself English, joined the military. But even after being in for many, many, many years, he never knew about this until he was approached. And what they do is different. So we'll get into the questions of why this, what's different between this and Special Mission Unit Delta, the Rangers, you know, Special Forces, the Green Berets, what makes you different? And it's interesting. And in fact, one of the things that makes them different, Murph, is exactly what you're talking about. Signals intelligence, the ability, they were wizards, the ability to pull stuff out of the air and do stuff, their special training. And so we're going to talk why do we have them on Game of Crimes? Well, it's still related to Game of Crimes because they are now going after their task with going after people that are the worst of the worst terrorists, the people that are recruiting people in the United States to do bad things. So we want to kill them there before they try and kill us here. And he's going to talk about one of those cases. So I enjoyed this. First of all, I enjoyed it because this guy came to the United States the right way. He did it the right way. He earned his stripes. He retired as a command sergeant major in E9. And when you see pictures in the book and the fruit salad that's on the left side of his chest and the number of service ribbons he's got, dude is a fucking badass. That's all I can say.
Absolutely. I'm so honored that we had Adam on the show here. His story is one, we highly recommend his book. His book's called The Unit. You can, and you'll hear us promote it at the end, but just at the beginning here, you can find it on Amazon. It just so happens that he had St. Martin's Press was his publisher. It's the same publisher that Javier and I had. And he actually had the same editor that we had, Mark Resnick. So highly encourage you to get his book and read it. If you're looking for something that tells you about the particulars, how they did secret missions, they're secret missions. You're not going to learn that in this book. But what you are going to find out is about someone who came from another country, appreciated what they had here in the United States, took advantage of all the capabilities. He earned, in my opinion, he earned the right to be called an American. He's an American citizen, and he sacrificed himself for our country. There's no greater calling than that. You know, the Bible says no greater calling, no greater honor than a man offer to lay down his life for his brother. And that's what Adam was willing to do, and you're going to hear about him getting shot here. So I just I'm fangirling over his stuff, and we've spent a couple of days talking to him. I'm still fangirling over him.
Yeah, so it's still, the name's still classified, so they call it the unit, the activity, the intelligence support activity, the first capabilities integration group. But whatever it is, there are people. I'm glad that there are people out there like this defending and protecting us around the globe. But Murph, we're not going to hear about this. We're not going to know about the stories, which we've got some exclusive stuff that he tells us and nobody else. Until I ask you the one question, are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, and most secret, we can't even tell you the name of the podcast anymore, game of all, the redacted
Game of Crimes.
It's redacted. It's classified. Are you ready to play it, no matter what we call it?
Hey, everybody, seriously, this is one you need to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. You're not going to believe the stories you're getting right here from Mr. Adam Gamal, or whatever your name is.
Murph was just saying right before we started, he actually read it. Don't lie, Murph. So who read it to you? That's who I want to know. Because it didn't come with, it's not a Marine Corps instruction manual. It didn't come with crayons.
He didn't put enough pictures in here. I mean, there are some pictures, but I like picture books.
So this is interesting. And we're going to introduce you here in just a brief second. But this started off because I was reading about this. And I reached out to one of the authors. Her name is Kelly Kennedy. She was very gracious. I reached out to her on Proton Mail because I don't know who's listening in on our conversations. So I said, hey, very interested. And come to find out, Murph, you and our guest here, both your books both come from the same publisher, St. Martin's.
That's right. We have both used Mark Resnick and St. Martin's Press. Did you ever meet him first face-to-face?
I did not meet him face to face. He promised me more than once to buy me dinner, but it hasn't happened yet. And hey, I'm like, I gotta go undercover, I guess.
You gotta go because he'll take you to Del Frisco's. It's gonna be an excellent steak.
And you know what? And actually, he said something about a steakhouse. So maybe it's the same place.
Well, the voice you're hearing, even us, people who have been trusted by the government at the highest levels, we still, to protect his identity, we don't even see him. We see just a little ball cap and a couple of eyes every now and then, like my cat in the dark. But hey, first of all, we want to welcome you under your nom de guerre, your assumed name of Adam Gamal. So first of all, Adam, this is us saluting you. Welcome to Game of Crime.
Welcome, brother. Glad to have you on the show.
Nice to be back. Thank you so much.
And I believe you retired, right, as an E-9 Command Sergeant Major?
Correct. I retired in 2016 as an E-9, and I retired on April 1st. And when I told everybody I'm retiring, they thought it was April Fool's Day, but I fooled them and I retired.
Hey, I got to ask you real quick. Did you know, of course, Jerry Boykin, General Boykin, did you know him?
No.
Do you know Iggy Balderas?
Yes.
Jack Alvarez?
I've heard the name, yes.
Some good people that I had the honor and pleasure to work with over the years. Still good people.
Well, hey, I can name drop too. Do you know Redacted? How about Redacted? It keeps kicking me.
I do know actually half of these guys.
Hey, well, what we want to talk about, and the reason I reached out is I saw this and immediately two things reached out to me about this book. Adam, you've got a book. It's called The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. And you wrote this with Kelly Kennedy. Well, the thing that intrigued me is I've been working on a book. I've got my first one done. Second one's coming out. My second one features a military capability known as the First Capabilities Integration Group, or the activity, or the unit. I learned about these guys over a year ago, probably 2 years ago. And I was trying to figure out a way. Well, then Murph and I get talking, and I know you can't say a lot of things, or you can neither confirm nor deny. But the one of the original capabilities, Murph, was Centrispike, and something you used down in Bogota to go after Pablo.
It was back in that day. Even the name Centrispike was classified, but it's all been declassified now. So we've been talking about it for a number of years, but. At that time, Centrispike for us was a twin-engine King Air that flew over the city of Medellin that intercepted telephone calls, radio communication, radio telephone calls. They were the guys that when Pablo would change his frequency on his phone, they were the guys that would go find him. Or, like towards the very end there, Javier got the frequency from an informant working with the family inside the Tequendama Hotel in Bogota. Happened to see the frequency. We sent that upstairs to another three-letter agency who sent it over to CenterSpike and confirmed we had the right guy, the right frequency. And as we know from the story now, that ultimately led to locating Pablo, and he had a really bad day.
Yeah. Shocker, folks. Spoiler, Pablo's dead. So, Adam, let's get talking to you, because we want to – I'm going to take you in a different direction initially, but I do want to just let people know, and I'm reading from the book jacket, but I want to highlight your career. Like, so you retired as a Command Sergeant Major E9. That's the highest rank you can get, you know, on the enlisted side, especially as a senior NCO. But your awards include the Bronze Star Medal, the Purple Heart, which we'll need to discuss, and the Legion of Merit. You were deployed more than a dozen times. So, brother, this, first of all, seriously, this is us thanking you, because you came to this country from Egypt. So let's start off as a youth in Egypt. How old were you when you left Egypt and came to the United States?
I was 20 years old. Did a couple of years in college. And then I can tell you more stories, but I'll let you ask questions.
Well, no. That's we want to do just kind of open ended, but it's kind of one of the things. So tell us about growing up in Egypt, because in the book, and obviously it's public information, you grew up in Alexandria. Alexandria's got a huge historical significance. Mm-hmm. One of the best libraries, the biggest libraries in the world in history at that time was Alexandria, and it burned down. But so much history out of Egypt. So what was it like growing up in Egypt during that time?
So Egypt, it was extremely interesting. It has two folds at the same time. Alexandria has its own unique culture, its own unique, the weather, the Mediterranean, the people there are a bit different than the rest of Egypt. They like to say that. They really pride themselves.
And that's kind of like being from Alabama or Texas. They're different too.
Correct.
You better be careful. You better be careful, man.
So, and speaking of the library in Alexandria, so they rebuilt the library, as you know. And right next door to the library, there is a hospital. It's a children's hospital. And that's where I was born. So I was born right next door to the Library of Alexandria. And right across the street from the library is Alexandria University, where it has the law school. And that's where I went a few years of college before I came to the U.S. So the Alexandria Library is very close to me physically. I used to go hang out there all the time in the area. And then during that time, you have, so I was born in the 70s, early 70s, and there was like the war between the Arab world and Israel, or Egypt in particular and Israel. You have the peace agreement in 1978. You have Jimmy Carter came to Egypt and literally was like one block away from my house.
It was Anwar Sadat, right, who was the president of, or the prime minister of Egypt at that time?
He was the president, correct. Anwar Sadat was the president of Egypt, who's, I mentioned him a lot in the book, because to me, he does, he is the real identity of a true Egyptian, where his family came half Egyptian, half Sudanese. The Egyptians, they like to say, were Egyptian sometimes, Mediterranean sometimes, Arab sometimes, African sometimes. So he wrote a book actually in search of self-identity, and he spoke about that. So during that time, here I am as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old kid. I saw Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat in one of those nice convertible cars passing by not far from my house. And my dad took me in his hand, and we went and we saw that. And for me, it was like historical, and never in my mind thought one day. And if you, this is information that we got from open source, that actually, before the unit was the unit, there was some people involved in, obviously, in missions like this, and like, you know, when the president is going to another country. So this is from open source, where here's a unit that was involved in something like this, me as a kid, seeing watching history happening in front of my eyes, and one day I'm part of that unit. Then, growing up, there was like, the struggle between, after Nasser died, you had Sadat, who's trying to fight the socialist regime that Nasser imposed in Egypt. And there was like huge movement, like following Nasser and Nasser's ideology. And so that's trying to fight that. So how do you fight that? The best way in his mind thought, taking the Muslim Brotherhood out of jail and including them into the political scene, not knowing that will bite him in the ass a few years later.
Yeah, because in 1981, he's assassinated. But yeah, sorry, Murph, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, can you tell us right off the bat about who the Muslim Brotherhood is? Because this is very, very important to what we're getting ready to talk about.
So the Muslim Brotherhood, it's the first in our recent history Islamic group that mixed Islam and politics. So it's more of a political Islam group. It started in 1928 by a guy, his name is Hassan al-Banna. He was a teacher. And then he started preaching from village to village. And actually, if you read his history or you read his bio, in one way, the guy will amaze you because he started from nowhere and he was able to, he was an organizational genius. History after that, like it shows like, you know, he was getting help from most likely Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was trying to combat the military regime in Egypt in the 50s. Nasser used the Muslim Brotherhood to get popularity. And after he got the popularity he needed, he realized they were more danger. They posed a lot of danger in the country and on the political scene in Egypt. So he executed their leaders and then pushed them underground. And in my opinion, when he pushed the MBs underground, that opened the door for any clown to go and talk about, to say, well, I'm part of this and I'm going to go to the basement and I'm going to talk, and nobody will be able to challenge them. And that kept progressing all the way till the 70s. They went back and forth fighting in disagreement between the government and the Muslim Brotherhood. Then the Muslim Brotherhood, they were not violent enough for some of their some of their groups. So out of the Muslim Brotherhood, you got the Jama'a Islamiya, you got the Islamic Jihad, you got, fast forward a bit more, you get Al-Qaeda, fast forward, you get Nusra Front, fast forward, you get ISIS, and nobody knows what's next. But in my belief, most of the Muslim extremist groups, they came out of the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And the corollary is kind of the Mexican Mafia became kind of an umbrella organization across all the other gangs, you know, because we've had one of the guys who was a shot caller for the Mexican Mafia, but the Muslim Brotherhood. What's interesting, though, Adam, is the Muslim Brotherhood is not outlawed in the United States, but in many countries, including Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood is outlawed.
Correct, correct. And that's a very, that takes me actually a bit back to something very interesting from my research. And I did have, as you guys saw in the book, I did have more than face-to-face interactions with them, whether they beating me up or whether we fighting or whether we run in student body elections against each other. But one thing is that really strikes me. When Nasser kicked the Muslim Brotherhood out of Egypt, the West took them. So a lot of them came to the U.S. And the ones who came to the U.S., so they came in the 60s. So if you were the son of a Muslim Brotherhood who was born in the U.S. in the 60s, you are in your late 50s, mid 50s now. So we have guys, and those guys are extremely good in hiding in plain sight. So a lot of them, you will not be able to know. So you, in your mind, you see the Taliban, the big beard, the how they dress. But a Muslim Brotherhood guy that you're not going to, he's not going to have a beard. He's going to be wearing normal clothes. You're not going to know unless you really get into talking to them more and watching them. So them not being outlawed in the U.S., it surprises me, but that's one of the other reasons too. I'm not showing my face because I know some of them are in the U.S. and they will tell you like they're not in any way trying to harm the U.S., but they are pushing money into the Middle East. They're destabilizing some of the countries in the Middle East.
Well, there was a very famous document found after 9/11, and it was found here in Northern Virginia. And it is called an exploratory memorandum on the general strategic goal for the Brotherhood in North America. And to me, that exactly lays out, they've been following that plan. I mean, you take a look at the Holy Land Foundation case, the largest terrorism financing case in U.S. history, 2005 out of Houston. They name all of these organizations that you're talking about that are part of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, these are unindicted co-conspirators. And to your point, they just hide in plain sight. Many of these were relief agencies, you know, so the kind of the reason we're kind of telling the story like that, kind of front loading it, is to kind of get into, as you're growing up and you're seeing all of this, this kind of forms, helps you form the basis for why you want to do something about it. I mean, I'm kind of stating the obvious, right? But what do you do about it? I mean, you're in Egypt, Anwar Sadat gets assassinated in 1981. You're still a kid there. You're like, what, 10 or 11 years old at that time. And you know, how do you go through all of that to get to the point where after a couple of years of college, you go, you know, hey, first of all, we welcome you to America, but what said, hey, I want to get to America. I want to do something different. What was the thought process that led you down that path to bringing you here to the United States?
So having a father like mine, and God bless his soul, you will not see a father telling his kid not to go to church or to go to mosque. Well, my father did. There was a mosque not far from my house where these guys, they start indoctrinating guys into their cult, for lack of a better term, into their cult early on.
Wait, so when you say these guys, are you talking about the Muslim Brotherhood guys?
Sure. Correct, the Muslim Brotherhood. Okay. So the Muslim Brotherhood, they start recruiting and indoctrinating guys early on. And if they see that you have leadership potential, even as a kid. So as a kid, I was very outgoing. I was playing basketball. I was in the Boy Scouts. I was doing a lot of activities to make me, that it showed, they found interest in me. So here I am, like 10-year-old kid. And here is a guy who's studying medicine in college, comes as he's in his way to the mosque, knocks on our door, and he tells my father, is Mr. Adam here? So he calls me as Mr. T. So my father is like, you know, who's that guy? And, you know, the couple of times my father asked the guy a couple of questions. And, okay, that's to any father, they'd be like, well, that's a good role model for my son. He's studying medicine. He's going to be a doctor. He's polite. He's going to the mosque. He's not taking my kid to go smoke drugs. But after a few times, it kind of like an antenna went up in my father's head. And he's like, you know, what's going on? And he asked the guy a few questions. And then he's like, you know, you can't go. And obviously, as a kid, I want to go. Here is a guy like, you know, 12, 14 years older than me, trying to be my friend. Of course, you want to be his friend. You want to be like, and he's going to be a doctor. And so my father started guiding me through those things and, like, you know, showing me the lights, showing me like, hey, be careful with people who take in religion to promote their agendas. Be careful with how what these guys saying. Slowly start like separating myself from that crowd. And then when I'm in college, like any kid in college, you want to go party, you want to go to field trips, you want to go do things. So I run for election for the student body against the Muslim Brotherhood, and I win, to everybody's surprise. And they planned on the one day, like it was a Saturday, and it was about 20 of us in a meeting preparing for a field trip. We were preparing actually for a Boy Scouts camp. And these guys, 100 of them came and beat the fuck out of us. And when I started, then there was like a big issue at that time. And we went to the police and went to the hospital. But a few days after, the guys who were with me in the student body from the Muslim Brotherhood, I asked one of them, I said, you know, you guys did this. You attacked us, and then next day you put flyers everywhere that we attacked you. And how do you justify lying? And he's like, the Prophet permitted lying in three occasions. One of them is divorce.
What they would call taqiyya, you know, it's okay to lie in certain instances to deceive your enemy.
Exactly. And I was like, so you believe that you are at war with whom? And he's like, we're at war with everybody who doesn't follow our methodology or our way of thinking or our ideology. So at that time, I'm studying law, and I had a college professor who's teaching us certain subjects, and he tells us like, hey, make sure that you learn it and you take it for the exam, and once you pass the exam, don't think about it too much, because Egypt at that time was under a state of emergency since the assassination of Sadat. So that was about in 9-10 years after. And he's like, you're never going to really practice this. So at that time, I had a light bulb came in my head, and I was like, I'm studying something I'm not going to practice. I'm running for an election. I win and I get beaten. The system doesn't protect me. The system doesn't do anything for me. So it's time to go. So that's when I decided to leave.
Can I ask you a question about the Quran? I have not read any part of the Quran that I know of, but in your opinion, and I know what your book says, and I know where this is going, and I already know the answer to the question I'm going to ask you, but is there anywhere in the Quran that says, you know, peace should be ignored, that you should not respect others, that you should not try to persuade people to come over through talking, but not through violence, things like that?
So let me caveat, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but in my limited education in Islam and what I was taught, and I read the Quran more than once, like any other Muslim, most likely the majority of Muslims read it. So I don't recall anywhere in the Quran where it says, let's just, if you come in and talk to me, let me just punch you in the face. Or let me just...
let me use violence.
Use violence without you using violence. It's like in the Bible, it's like an eye for an eye. And then we say, hey guys, if we got an eye for an eye, we're going to leave a world of blind people. So it's Islam is an extension to Judaism and Christianity. You're not going to find a lot of difference. If anybody really reads it and study it, you're not going to find that major differences between the three religions.
And I just, you know, I want to get that out there just because there's, you know, there were, people have perverted the Quran just like they've perverted the Bible and the Quran to their own means. And, you know, it as we're going to get into, it results in anti-Muslim beliefs, anti-Jewish beliefs, anti-anybody that's not believing the way I believe. And so I just want to get that out there, that book does not promote violence. Right. I just want to make sure that our listeners understand that.
Yeah. And the one thing, too, I want to highlight to our listeners, too, is it's very easy to follow a narrative that it's being promoted by certain people. And by the way, we are playing into the extremists' hands. They that's what they wanted. I mean, they want us to hate. They want us to keep talking bad about them. And I was telling somebody, like when I was in Iraq, when Abu Ghraib happened, and I was like, this is the best recruiting pamphlet for Al-Qaeda. And some guy was sitting with me there who's a very smart guy. He was from a unit deploying with me, and he's like, why is that? And I was like, and I think he was asking the question in a rhetorical way, just he wants to have a conversation. And I was like, so right now you have the Bin Ladens, and the Bin Ladens likes can go and find one verse in the Quran who's saying, if somebody does this to you, you go kill him. And by the way, there are things in the Quran, there are, like they call it the reason of revelations. And I've learned this, by the way, in a U.S. government course by a guy with a PhD in Islamic studies and spoke Arabic fluently. And he's as white as both of you guys. But so a lot of people don't realize that. So I've learned this from somebody, and I did my research. So the reason of revelation, it's for a specific verse was revealed for a specific occasion to take specific actions. You cannot come 1,500 years after and say, 1,500 years ago, that verse were revealed to do 1, 2, 3, and we're going to apply it now. But because of the lack of education, it's very easy for extremist groups to go and when you tell a 12-year-old kid, let's do this. And this is what the Quran says. And you're not going to teach him. It's like you take bits and pieces out of the Quran, you tailor it to your agenda, and that's what you tell people. And it's like in any religion. If you take any religion and you use it for to get political gains, that's what you would do. And it's been done for the last, even before religions, for the last hundreds and thousands of years.
So I want to respectfully disagree with a couple of things, and I'll tell you why. A good friend of mine, Stephen Coughlin, was the advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff right after 9/11. He is probably the foremost expert on Islamic law in the Western Hemisphere, and I've got the Quran here, the Reliance of the Traveler, one of the four approved editions. What I will say, you know, look, the difference is between people who have come to the United States or they've assimilated, everybody has moderated views. But if you go back and if you look at what Nidal Hassan did at Fort Hood or what Osama bin Laden said, they were factually correct. In other words, before you perpetrate violence, the first thing you do is you call them to revert or, you know, revert back to being Muslim, to Islam. If you don't, then you pay the jizya, the tax. And then only if you don't do those two things can you wage war. And so what I'm saying is, you know, having studied this for a variety of reasons and getting in depth with people who are well-doctrinated in the field, I think there's so much nuance here. What I don't want to do is say it's just completely one thing or the other. But what I will say is you've got people out there like Zudi Jasser and other folks who are saying, hey, look, if you want to practice religion, but when there is a section of a certain percentage of people who want to live the orthodox version of it, I mean, who want to take it to exactly what it says, what it literal meaning means, that's a problem no matter what religion you're in. But the only reason I say that is I just wanted to push back a little bit and say, well, you know, having studied it as well too, and the concept of abrogation, that what is said later abrogates what comes before, it's like setting precedent. There are some things that do cause problems in the analysis of, you know, doctrine, you know, the doctrine of your enemy. If you can't define the enemy, you can't defeat them. So I'm just saying that just as so we can have a good conversation here. But the one thing I agree with exactly what you were saying, Adam, is I think the Muslim Brotherhood is totally underestimated in terms of their power, their influence, and what they're doing. And not everything involves chopping somebody's head off or committing violence. Most of this stuff is done the way the power is wielded, soft power, is through politics, it's through money, it's through influence, it's through organizations, and by simply just taking over things a little at a time. And you're not going to do it if you look like you're a imam that just jumped out of the most radical, you know, mosque, you know, in Iraq, as opposed to your point, business suit, clean cut hair, business car, you know, doesn't raise any red flags. That's to me is the more dangerous person.
Can I push back and you push him back?
Dude, this is America. You fought for us. We fought for you, brother. Bring it on.
So I agree with you 100% on what he said. But like I said, there are certain circumstances, and there are certain criteria have to be present before you can do that. So I do agree with you. Like you have to. There are things in Islam where it says, like, you know, you ask him for. To convert. If they don't convert, you ask them to pay the tax. And if you don't, but it was during what they call it, the expansion. So basically it was, let's say the Islamic empire, for lack of a better term, moved to North Africa. They moved to Egypt and then they
the caliphate, right?
Yes, the caliphate. And then they go to Egypt and they say, okay, now we occupied your country. We conquered your country. And those are the options that you have. This was between governments and governments, countries and countries. It was during, again, this the last time it happened, most likely it was over 1,000 years ago. So we cannot go and say, now I'm a guy who immigrated to the U.S. I'm not coming to convert you. You're not trying to convert me. I'm coming to the U.S. to make it home. And then, hey, by the way, if you don't convert to Islam, I'm going to kill you. Well, that doesn't make any sense. So this is just, to have that good conversation and to push back on each other and make fun of each other, most likely. You know,
okay, speaking of making fun of each other, pal, all right, you can see us, we can't see you. Before we get started, you did a lot of operations that remain classified because the Publication Review Board, DOD, won't let you talk about them. You've got the things that we can talk about in the book. I'm not interested in that, pal. I want to know, after you join, what's the best practical joke you ever pulled on a buddy? And don't tell me it's classified. Don't give me that crap.
Not.
But what's the best either pulled on you or you pulled on somebody?
So I'm sure you've heard this before. When you go get, they ask you to go find Kim Light batteries.
So and prop wash, turbo wash, you know?
Exactly. So here I am. And like, I'm in the 82nd. And they tried to do that. And I was like, you've fucking heard that before. And then they were like, okay, why didn't you go get the keys to the drop zone? And I'm like, well, I dropped in airborne school, but I'm coming here. Maybe in the 82nd, they have a keys to the drop zone. And I'm like, well, who has the keys to the drop zone? They said, by the way, I was an E6 at that time. I mean, I was a staff sergeant. And they were like, go ask the first sergeant. So I went ask the first sergeant. And that's the same first sergeant. Actually, he recommended me to attend the briefing for the unit. And then obviously in the 82nd, when I just in the 82nd, when like I loved, you know, like that, just the camaraderie and the soldiering, and you steal the guidon from the other company. The other company steal the guidon from you. So when we were in the field one time, we stole the guidon of another company, and they couldn't find it for days. So those are the things that just fun things that you just keep doing when you are a young soldier.
Breaks up the monotony.
Well, yep. And everybody does that shit. So, well, okay. I just want to kind of get that out of the way. Just kind of go back to having fun now, because we had our serious part of the discussion, which is good. You know, we've got to have these discussions, but let's talk about, so you said, you said still kind of under martial law in Egypt, you couldn't really practice what you were studying for. Why pick the United States? What was it about coming to the United States that said, this is my opportunity?
So this is funny, honestly. I was like, this was right after Desert Storm. So I didn't think the United States would give me a visa. It was me and two other guys.
Why didn't you think that? Simply because you were from Egypt or another issue?
No, it was hard at that time for a poor Egyptian to get a visa to go to the U.S. because they are like, well, how are you going to support yourself? How are you going to travel? Who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for that? And then during Desert Storm, there was a lot of demonstrations in Egypt against the U.S. So I was like, well, I'm not sure if they will do that. So me and these two other guys, we decided we're going to try to go to Austria, Vienna. And we go and they said, no, we're not giving visas this year because of the situation and the war situation. And unless you have a first degree relative who lives there, who is actually an Austrian citizen. So we didn't. We went to the French embassy. They said the same thing. And in the way back, as we're walking back, there is the U.S. consulate. And the one guy was like, hey, I went with you guys to the French embassy, to the Austrian embassy. I never wanted to go there. I want to go to the U.S. So literally, I told the guy, these two other countries didn't give us a visa. You think the U.S. will give us a visa? And he's like, we have nothing to lose. Let's just try. So we passed. And obviously, it's everybody's dream to come to the U.S. People who were born in the U.S., they take it for granted. But it's everybody's dream. So we went and the guy gave us an application, filled out the applications. The first time they told me, like, you need to get more documents to show financial capability that you can travel.
Did you have any family in the United States or any relatives?
No, nobody. Nobody at all. I had a friend who was in the Boy Scouts with me who came to the U.S. 2 years before I did. But I didn't, we were not that close that I would, like, go and say I have somebody there. So literally, here's the funny story, and hopefully nobody from the immigration is listening or nobody from the State Department.
I think you're safe now.
So I go. So the lady asked me, she's like, can you bring documents? It shows that you can financially support yourself. I said, yes, of course I can. And she's like, when can you bring it? Can you bring it tomorrow? I said, we're not in the U.S. We're in Egypt. It's going to take me 2 days. So the lady was like, okay. Can you come the day after tomorrow? So I went and I got one of those small, very small, tiny brief bags, like a small bag, totally empty, by the way. And I went back and I walked in and the lady was like, I was like, here, I was here 2 days ago. You asked me for documents. I brought the documents. Would you like to see them? And she's like, no. In her mind, and I didn't know, honestly. And I was like, I didn't know if she said I wanted to see them, what I would have said. Most likely I was going to open the bag and say, damn, I lost them. But I walked in like I belong. I walked in like I have everything. And the lady was like, and by the way, the first time I went, I didn't even have the money for the visa. The second time I went, my brother gave me, I think it was like $3, the fees for the visa. So I walk in and the lady was like, give me $3. And I was like, why? She's like, because we're giving you a visa. I was shocked. I was happy. I was ecstatic. And believe it or not, a week after that, I was in New York City.
Wow.
Well, if you couldn't afford $3 for a visa, how'd you afford a ticket to get to New York City?
I borrowed $500 from my sister, and I borrowed money from my mom to buy me a ticket.
Have you paid them back?
I did, actually with interest, believe it or not. By the way, I was their best investment ever. I was their best investment.
So let's talk about what year did you land in New York City then? About 92, 93?
91.
91.
Yep, 91.
What was your first impression landing in New York City?
It's not what I saw in on Hollywood movies. I just saw, like, at that time, the movie Pretty Woman was just out like a year before. And I'm like, where is Richard Gere? Where are the limos? And where are all of these things? So I was like, man, I got fooled. Am I in the U.S. for real?
Welcome to reality.
And then, I spent my first night in the YMCA in a shady area in New York City. And I couldn't even dial like a payphone. Like, I had my friend, the one I told you about from the Boy Scouts. I had his phone number. But his mom, when she gave me the number, she didn't put the one before the area code.
Oh.
So here I am trying to call, and it's not going through.
It's not. Now, did you speak any English at all?
No, I didn't speak any English to the point I annoyed the bus driver. I had a booklet with all the YMCA's addresses. So the bus driver, from JFK to go to the subway, there is a free shuttle bus. Obviously, in Egypt, there are no free anything. So I'm like, how am I going to pay for this bus? And nobody's asking me for money. So I'm like, what's wrong with these people? So I asked the driver a few times. And I just, the very two, three words, how can I go to this actually? I say this address. So he takes the booklet and he tells me something I don't understand. I asked him a few times because I don't see people getting off the bus. I'm like, are we going in the right direction, wrong direction? Finally, he took the booklet and sat me down. At the end of the bus line, he gives me the book and he's like, get out. Me and everybody else in the bus, I followed people to the subway, watch what people doing to buy the ticket. My buddy decided, so it was me and another guy. The third guy didn't get a visa. The rich guy, actually, who had the financial capability to travel, did not get a visa. So I was like, and he's the guy who was trying to convince us we really have to come to the U.S.
Only the State Department can come up with that logic.
And you never know, honestly, how, based on what, but I was lucky, so I'm not complaining. Thank you, State Department. I did a couple of tours with the State Department as a military guy, so now I know how they think. But my buddy, who's with me, he decided to light a cigarette in the subway. And we have to, those two, everybody has a big suitcase. I have my $500 hidden in my socks and the socks I'm wearing because I'm terrified. And I looked a lot younger than my age. And my buddy's like, everybody's looking at us. And my buddy's like, why are people looking at us? I said, dude, I don't know. Maybe because you're smoking. And he's like, no, everybody smokes. They smoke in movies. And obviously people were looking at us because there is a big no smoke sign behind our back.
And we don't read English yet at this point.
But there is a sign, and there is a sign, like, you know, with an X on it for the cigarette. So I'm like, but we were morons. Really fresh off the boat, 100% fresh off the boat. And so we finally get off the subway where the train station where the YMCA is at, and it's a Sunday, and I can't get it out. I cannot make my way out of the subway because a lot of the turnstiles are locked on Sunday. Police officer standing there, he tried to give me directions. I can't make it. After like three, four times, he grabbed my hand and he walked me out to the streets. And it was raining. And I'm like, man, it doesn't rain in Egypt in the summer. What the heck is going on? So the first impression was like, it's raining in July. I don't understand what anybody's saying. The subway, for anybody who's never been to the subway in New York, it stinks. I'm like, this is not what I saw in Hollywood. Where is Julia Roberts? Like, I was looking for Julia Roberts and I couldn't find her. So that's my first impression. But let me add something to this. A couple of months after, it was my first time seeing snow. And I'm working in a factory that makes handbags. And I'm going to school. So I leave the factory around 5, 6 o'clock. And then my classes start from like 7 to 9. I was taking English as second language classes. And it starts snowing. So you see this snowflakes coming down. And you're like, it's really, I thought, because it's an industrial area, I thought there is cotton falling off the sky. Like, I thought actually there's a factory like doing some textile.
You thought it was like pollution or something from the factory falling on you?
Exactly. And I'm like, what is that coming down? And it was really weird for me. And then this thing starts sticking in the ground and I'm like, snow. And I'm like, okay, finally I saw snow. But at the same time, with the crisp air comes down with the snow, you feel like you can really breathe. And you can feel that you feel like you breathe in freedom. Here I am, a kid from Egypt, going, taking classes, walking in the streets of New York City. And it was a blessing. And for a lot of people, they're like, man, you were suffering. I was making like tomato sandwiches because I didn't have money. So just bread and tomatoes. But it was a blessing. And a lot of people, again, a lot of people take this for granted. I didn't. I took every opportunity America decided to give me or not give me. I took it.
Hey, you know what? You know what I had for breakfast this morning? A tomato sandwich.
Tomato sandwich.
Dude, you're that fucking poor?
Yeah, I am.
We're one paycheck away from eating cat food. That's why we got to make some money doing this podcast.
That's right, brother. Times are tough.
Well, hey, but here's a point I want to make about what you did, Adam. You came over legally. I'm not getting political, folks. I'm making a statement. You came over legally, but you did what was very important to do because New York's a great melting pot, but you assimilated. You said, I'm going to learn English. You know, I'm going to do certain things. And you know what? When people do that, what they forget is, I think what people miss is that you bring the richness of your culture over here. We learn something from it. You learn something from us. Everybody improves. But if you just went and stayed with people who were Egyptian and you only spoke Arabic and you didn't get out and meet anybody else, it would be like you've just picked up a piece of Egypt, just stuck it in New York, and you've never learned the American experience. So again, this is us saluting you, saying that is the example. That's what I'd love to see. And obviously, you're going to get into the Army, which, by the way, Army, hooah, you know, it's the best branch of all. Yeah. Go Army, beat Navy.
Can I add something? Can I add something to what you just said?
Absolutely.
So, Morgan, you hit the nail on the head because I've seen this. So, yes, I came legally 100%. Again, I'm not getting into politics. Politicians are using the immigration as a campaign ticket or whatever. That's not why I'm here. I don't even entertain the idea of talking about any of these things. But one of the things that I wrote the book for, exactly to what you just said, the immigrant community. So what I tell people, when you came to the U.S., you got the kid out of Egypt, but you didn't get the Egypt out of the kid. And I'm like, if you come into the U.S. and the U.S. has given you all of these opportunities, and it's a, by the way, it's an opportunity that not a lot of countries will give to give an immigrant the opportunity to join the military and serve. In Egypt, unless you are like seventh generation Egyptians, you cannot go to the military. So one of the things I wanted to get like people to read the book with an open-minded people to read it in a way, guys, when you come to the U.S., it's your new home. It's giving you a lot of opportunities. Take advantage of those opportunities and embrace it. And protect your new home. Joining the military is nothing wrong with it. I used to have people telling me, like, I'm going to get my arms broken, my legs broken. I'm doing the wrong thing by joining the military. But what I want to tell people, like, when you come to the U.S., it's an you didn't achieve your goal yet. Some people think, I arrived, I'm here, you know what? That's it, I'm done. I'm in the U.S. now. Well, you can make the best out of it by working harder, by doing more, but you didn't come to the U.S. just to say, I came to the U.S. You have a lot more to do.
That's I love the way you're explaining it. It's and I, you know, we do try to stay political here. I will say, you did it legally. My daughters are adopted Colombians. They immigrated to the United States when we transferred back. They're naturalized citizens. We did it legally. That's all we're asking in our country is for the immigrants to do it legally. And that, you know, that's what this whole that border thing is. But you're hitting the nail on the head also, just like you said about Morgan, is that you come in and you do bring a richness of culture that I may never see personally, but you did assimilate to the way things are done in the United States. That doesn't mean you have to change your religion, change the way you dress, change the food that you eat. You know, it's just you're here to get along with everybody else. And it's get on my soapbox just for a second. It's up to each of us every day how good or how bad things are going to be. You know, you can let other people control your life, or you can make the decision that I'm going to do this, which, you know, that's called leadership. It's just very encouraging to hear that you come in with that attitude. And of course, I've already read your book and I know how successful you're going to be. But you, in my opinion, you did it the right way, man. Congratulations. That's the way it's supposed to be done.
Thank you. And one thing, sorry, but one thing too is what I tell people, like, again, if you go into Saudi Arabia, you're not going to walk around the streets in a bikini. So when you come to the US, you might want to adjust the way how you do things. It's you're not changing your ways. You're not changing your skin. You adjusting to the environment around you. So there is I tell my kids, you're extremely lucky that you are being raised with two different cultures, and you can pick and choose the best of both of them. You don't have to pick one over the other. And I was lucky that way. I was very fortunate that I was taught as a kid to observe and look at things and evaluate it and then pick and choose. If I come to the States and you're telling me, like, you know what, walk around the street naked. Well, I don't walk around the street naked. But
if you do that in San Francisco, it's considered normal. So, you know, depends.
We're not gonna discuss those things now. Let's just go back to
what we're talking about. We get it. But I will tell you, just last point, let's move on because I want to talk about your military stuff. But I was telling you before we started, you know, my dad was Army, World War II and a Vietnam vet. I was born at Fort Riley. Moved around the world, but spent 3 years in Iran. And to the point about having the richness of culture and stuff, one of the things that was great moving out to Northern Virginia is I was able to find some authentic Persian restaurants. Go get the kebabs, go get the rice, you know, the way it was when I was growing up. And it's like, that's what I'm talking about. You know, it's like going through Little Italy and getting real pizza, going through the French Quarter, you know, going through Chinatown and getting, you know, real authentic food, Mexican food. You know, I think that's the thing that we talk about. That's what makes America great. But to your point, you got to do the work, though. If you come here, you just can't. The goal is not to just get here. You know, it's one of the lessons I learned from endurance athletes and really top tier ones is you didn't come this far just to come this far. You came this far because the goal is to finish. You know, it's to get to the end line. So with all of that motivational speaking, and I am taking requests to do motivational speaking, just contact me.
Oh, sorry. I took a little nap there. Sorry. Go ahead.
You take naps all the time. Hey, well, let's talk about you, though, getting into the Army. So how long were you in these United States of America? A lot of people say the United States of America. It's the United States of America. How long were you in the good old US of A before the idea came that, hey, maybe I can join this thing called the Army?
Cuatro. That's
cuatro.
4 years.
Habla español?
Poquito.
Poquito.
So 4 years. And again, I had some serious decisions to make. I have, again, you come and you are surrounded by the immigrant Egyptian community or the Arab community in general, because there was like Egyptians, Lebanese, Jordanians. There was all of the Arab deep stuck together in certain areas. And I was in Jersey City. And I mentioned this in the book, and I'll tell you this because I find it very entertaining. A lot of people will, where do you go and find Egyptians who like you? You go to the mosque. If you go to Yemen tomorrow, where are you going to find Americans? You go to the church. So I went to a mosque in Jersey City, and the blind sheikh, Omar Abdurrahman, was there.
Which, and, for folks to...
It's not a good thing.
Well, it's not, but just to tie it together, he was one of the people convicted in the first World Trade Center bombings.
Correct. And he died in jail a few years ago. And he's a guy who was behind the assassination of Sadat in Egypt. And here I am. I've heard about this guy a lot. And here I am in the U.S., and I'm sitting in the same place as this guy. And after a Friday prayer, he sits down and people go around and ask him questions. And I'm like, I'm going to sit and figure out what this guy's talking about. I'm curious. And the second question somebody asked him, he was like, is blowjob forbidden in Islam? And I'm like, so this brain with this scholar, and that's what you guys asking him? Obviously, he's not a scholar. And obviously, the guy who's asking the question is an idiot. So to get your listeners to buy the book, I'm not going to tell you what his answer was.
I love it.
That's what they call a tease.
It's all about marketing. It's all about marketing. I love it.
But if you want to know what was the verdict about blowjob in the eyes of the blind sheikh, as we call them in the U.S.,
yep.
Buy the book. You'll find it. I'm not going to tell you even which page.
Let me look at the index and see if you have blowjob indexed in here.
Yeah. Let's see here. I got the book here with me, too. Nope, not listed in there. Okay.
Nope. We're going to have to list it. Oh, there's blind chic.
Yeah, there's blind chic. Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Well, there's like five or six page revers in there. So
damn marketing people.
All jokes aside, I'm working literally two jobs. So I would go wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go deliver cakes and bakery and bread and cookies from a bakery to hotels. I finish around 6-7 o'clock in the morning, go home, take a shower, change real quick, go to work. From 9 to 5, then go to school from around 7 to 9. So here I am, I'm up from 2 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. And I see this recruiting station. And an army recruiter was passing by and he talked to me about it. And then I was like, oh, I'm not really sure, let me think. And I'm like, but I asked him questions like, you know, he's like, how are you paying for your school? I said, I'm working my ass off. And literally I'm working about 17, 18 hours a day.
And you know, the recruiter's going to go, have you heard about the GI Bill, son?
Yeah.
Have you heard we'll pay for your education?
Absolutely. And you know what? It sold me. So he tells me that and he's like, we'll pay for your school. And I'm in school at that time. So I go, think a few weeks after I went to the recruiting station, but I wanted to join the Navy. I lived in the Mediterranean.
You know why you wanted to join the Navy? No, it's because you stayed at the YMCA and you saw the village people singing YMCA and you wanted to be a Navy guy. We That's get terrible. It.
You know what? I never connected that. Now I'm glad you did.
That's what we're here for.
You're an analyst. You're a good analyst, aren't you?
He's an analyst, I believe.
So I go and the Navy guy is not there. The Army guy is there. And the Army guy is like, why do you want to join the Navy? And he's like, you know what? We have boats more than the Navy. We have this, we have this, we have this. And finally, I went ahead and the Army guy sold me. And I joined the Army. And initially, they told me you should be a tanker. And I told the guy why. And he's like, because you are too small, you're going to fit in the tank. You're gonna have room.
Hey, speaking of that, you know, a lot of people, it's in the book. Yes, read the book. We get that. But just give us real quickly, what are your physical dimensions?
I'm 6'7".
Not in your mind, in reality.
Oh, in reality. Yeah. I'm 5'1". Right now, I'm 5'1", about 140 pounds. When I joined the Army, I was 5'1", 112 pounds.
Yeah, you wouldn't have just fit in the tank. You would have fit in the barrel of the M1.
Possibly. And then they would fire me and I would choke people.
Fire me. Whoosh.
Hey, but you know what? I mean, based on just your physical dimensions, don't underestimate this guy. Because I got to tell you, the worst butt kicking I ever got when I was a kid fighting was from a guy smaller than me. Never underestimate.
I used to go, the unit used to send us to do a lot of Krav Maga.
Oh, yeah.
When we would go, the Krav Maga, the trainer used to like, you know, get you to warm up to get to the point where you are angry and like you have the anger to fight, right? And he was like, dude, with you, I never have to do that. You are so feisty. As soon as we say fight, you fight. So my dad taught me this. If you are a small guy, you cannot let the guy in front of you take the first punch because he'll take you out. So don't try to get in a fight with me. I carried the same or not heavier rucksack than anybody else. Because when we jump, they want to balance. When you jump out of an aircraft, they want to balance weight. So how do you balance weight? You give the light guy more weight. So I used to carry the radio and the batteries when I was in the 82nd. And then we would land and I had to carry that shit and ruck with it. And I'm like, guys, we landed already. Can we like start distributing batteries? No, man, it's your rucksack. You carry your own stuff.
And you know, the keys to the drop zone are pretty heavy too, aren't they?
Yes. Yes. But I used to hide those in my pocket sometimes. And then I would take and lock the drop zone and leave.
There you go. The drop zone.
See, I told you we're going to have fun.
Well, I know, but that's the point. We do serious stuff. But no, we were talking about joining the Army. So there's a lot of stuff in the book, so I don't want to rehash just like the general story getting up to it. What I want to talk about now is transitioning into What was your experience joining the Army? And then, like you said, you rose up through the ranks, you know, E1 through E6. And it was at E6, you said, is when you had your first introduction into what is we refer to as the unit. Is that right?
Correct. So I came into the Army as an E3. I was lucky. I had some college. So they
Where'd
were
you
nice
go through basic at?
Fort Jackson.
I went through Fort Lost in the Woods, Misery, June and July of 1979. The worst 2 months in the world you can go through basic training anywhere in the world.
That's why they call it Misery.
Yes, Fort Lost in the Woods, Misery. I'm telling you, man.
So, yeah. So I went to basic and AIT in Fort Jackson. AIT is the Advanced Individual Training for our non-military people.
What was your initial military occupation specialty, as they say, MOS? What did you start off doing?
So it used to be 71 Lima, which is the administrative specialist, and the recruiter sold it to me.
You wanted to be a tanker. Now you go to an administrative specialist?
So when he told me, we're going to make you a tanker because you're small, I got offended. And I said, no. I said, I have a brain. I want to use my brain. So he's like, I have this awesome job. You're going to learn. You're going to be a computer genius. And obviously the military, if you ever have the chance, I'm sure you guys did. Read the MOS descriptions of the manual for the MOS descriptions. They have like petroleum specialist, and you think the guy gonna be like a petrol engineer? No, he's the guy who puts gas in the car. So when he told me about administrative specialist, and he sold it to me as like it's a really cool job, and I'm gonna be a genius, computer genius. So I signed for it, and I went. And I have no regrets, by the way. I've learned a lot. I've learned how to type. So,
but you also learn not to trust a damn thing recruiters tell you either, right?
Absolutely. So that's why they gave us the GI Bill to learn after that, but it was after the fact. It was too late. So I went. But the good thing about an administrative specialist, you can get assigned to any unit. So you're not stuck in one unit or another. So my first unit was a military police unit, deployed to Bosnia with them. Second unit was an infantry unit, deployed to Kosovo with them. I spent some time in Germany. When I was in basic training and in AIT, again, administrative MOS is one of the few MOSs you as a non-US citizen can join the Army as. So they have a couple of them, and administrative specialist is one of them. So we had a good percentage, not very high, obviously, like maybe less than 5% of immigrants. So we had one, she was Nigerian, grew up in the UK, became a lawyer, moved to New York, went to NYU for law school, then joined the Army. And when she spoke English, the drill sergeants were like, can you repeat and just speak normal English because we don't understand you? She was so high up there. She was a great runner. She was older than all of us. And I asked her, I said, so you are a lawyer. Why did you join the Army? Her answer was to write a book, because you can, if you are in the Army or in jail, you have all kind of different people. So I didn't know that I was going to join the Army in 20 years after I write a book, but she was writing her book back then.
I guess it was better than going to jail, right?
It was a lot better than going to jail. And she was a lot smarter than a person who would go to jail. But you meet a lot of different people in those MOSs. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as you're working up through this, at some point you talked about the 82nd Airborne. Did you do any specialized training up to that point? Did you go through jump school? Did you go through air assault, you know, airborne? I mean, did you get to go to any additional training prior to that, you know, being an E6?
Yeah, so I did airborne school as an E5. I did a lot of other, like, you know, you get those small badges for doing, like, you know, you are the guy who does some competitions in the infantry unit. I was the soldier of the year in 1st Infantry Division. I was competing for different things. And I realized, like, you know what? I was born to be in the Army. And people, this is a cliche. It's not. I was like, and my wife tells me this. She's like, you're so lucky. You found a job that you really love. So me being in the Army was like my thing. I was like, you know what? This is it. It's easy for me to take correspondence courses. I'm the annoying guy who runs around the formation carrying the guide on. I'm the guy who's like, you know, taking college classes in the evening. The Army was like awesome for me. Obviously, the beginning, and the Army is not easy. as you guys know. But obviously, in the beginning, it was a bit tough. But you found a family. You came from Egypt, and your family's not in the U.S., but you found a family in the Army, and I did. I found people who supported me, who kind of like held my hands, who took me and showed me the rope. And were some people assholes? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a guy used to call me a camel jockey. And it didn't bother me, by the way, because I didn't know what it means.
Well, he said it was love, didn't he?
So my platoon sergeant came and he's like, hey, doesn't it bother you? I said, honestly, I don't know what it means. And he's like, it should offend you. And then he explained to me what's a camel jockey. And so they brought the guy, he's an E5, and he apologized to me. But I know the guy didn't mean anything bad with it. He was just being funny. But I kept learning. And then, you know, the first book I read, the first full book it came through the MWR care packages that you come when you are deploying. So I was in Bosnia and I got this, and my platoon sergeant, again, still the same guy, Sergeant First Class Mark Green, that I owe him where I reached in the Army, because he really taught me what the Army means and how you can excel as a soldier. And back then, one of them was spit shine your boots. So I used to spit shine my boots. But there are more things, obviously, to it. And then I knew I wanted to do something else. So when I was in Germany, I called the MI branch, the interrogator branch, and I wanted to become an interrogator. And by then, I became a U.S. citizen, by the way, before that. They sent me from Germany to the U.S. to get my U.S. citizenship. And for the people who went through these experiences, they know how emotional it is. And you really feel it. I mean, you know what? They do a good job. And I got a letter from, at that time, President Clinton, congratulating me for making the right decision of becoming a U.S. citizen. And I was like, dude, it's a dream for a lot of people. It's not like it's a dream. So I tried to become an interrogator in the Army. That was 1999. They said they don't need any Arabic interrogators. And
yeah,
I said,
not yet. Yeah.
Yeah. I said, you don't need to send me to school. You don't need to send me. I am ready to go. And he's like, no. Then the SIGIN branch contacted me and they said, you can reclass to be a SIGIN guy, signal intelligence guy. And they were going to send me to DLI to be an MLI, to be like a military language instructor.
Yeah. And that's where my dad went through. That's where my dad went through before we went to Iran, was out at Monterey. So he went through, learned Farsi, you know, the Defense Language Institute. Let's talk about this now, because we want to start talking. Let's get into the meat of this now, the unit. You're an E6, which is a staff sergeant. Prior to that time, had you known anything at all about the unit? We'll call it the unit. It has several different names. People can look it up. But had you heard anything at all, even whiffs, about the unit? Everybody knew about one of the worst kept secrets, but Delta, Special Mission Unit Delta. You know, you got the Special Forces, Green Berets, you got Rangers. Had you had a whiff at all about the unit?
Absolutely not. I didn't know they existed. I did not know anything about it. Nobody ever talked to me about it. And it was the best thing that happened to me, that I did not know anything about it, because it's by design. If you don't know anything about it, when you go through selection, like don't G2 selection, don't try to figure out, but I did not know anything. I was in Fort Bragg, jumping 2-3 times a week, busting my butt and running and doing all of these cool things. And my first sergeant came to me and he's like, hey, at the theater, there is a briefing about a special mission unit. And honestly, I didn't even know what special mission unit means. But I knew Delta because I was in Bragg. So I knew the Rangers, you know, all of these guys. And I was like, what do they do? He's like, I can tell you, I don't really know, but you should go to the briefing. So I went to the briefing and I left the briefing not knowing what they do.
Hey, real quickly, now that you're looking back on it retrospectively, what was it about you that got you invited to that briefing? What kind of qualities was the unit looking for that you possess that they said, hey, let's get this guy in?
So I wish I knew. I think it was my good look. I'm a very good looking guy.
Well, we can't tell. You look like a ball cap with a fluorescent rim. That's it.
This is my opportunity to live my dream. So, no, the unit actually, they look at guys with good language skills, hard skills. Like they wanted guys who were in like airborne SF guys. Obviously, not that's not only the only criteria, but those are some of the criteria. And they look at guys who can think on their own, can solve problems, can work totally on their own, and work extremely well in teams. And the most important thing, have the grit that you are not gonna quit shit. Because like any selection process in any special mission unit, what they put you through physically, it will break you. But once you are tired physically, your mental, your brain keeps pushing. When does your brain tell you to quit? Some people, their brain tells them to quit as soon as they find themselves by themselves. People don't like to be alone. People don't like to be in the dark. People have phobias from different things. People don't like to be in heights. So they look for people who have the grit and the skill set to operate worldwide, doing missions either as a singleton or as a part of a team. They can lead and they don't mind being led, and obviously have the highest level of integrity.
Let's again, looking back retrospectively now, the Army has got, I mean, you know, and Murph, you talked about this too, you know, at that time, Colonel Boykin, but around the, you know, the origins of Delta and the reasons for Delta. And we can go back to the Iranian hostage mission and Chuck Beckworth. What was it that the military was missing? What capability was it they were missing that none of the others could fulfill that they said, we've got to have the unit? Was it just additional secrecy? Or, I mean, what's going to differentiate between what you do and what Special Mission Unit Delta does?
It's a good question. We have the special operation skill set and the intelligence skill set. So we are not the guys who are going trying to break doors. We're not the guys who are trying to go put a gun in your head. We are more the guys who are trying to set the environment to make sure that we can get somebody to put a gun in your head, or we can get you somewhere where somebody can put a gun in your head. So what they were missing is the intelligence capability. The skill set is to operate in the gray area. I love my Delta and my SEAL Team 6 brothers. They love to talk about themselves. We don't. They wanted guys who stay under the radar. And then a lot of people will tell you, you don't like to talk about yourself. Why did you write a book? When you read the book, you'll know. So I'm not gonna go into that. But I think that's the biggest piece that was missing. It was missing that people can operate to in foreign countries undetected. When you bring the Delta guy or the Navy SEAL guy, literally I had guys with them deploying with me in some countries. And as we walk in the market, the lady selling us something, she'd be like, are you in the Army? Are you in the Army? Because you can, they look at they how they carry themselves. We are capable of carrying, we are in the Army, we are capable of carrying our own weight, doing all of these things, but your demeanor is different. So they were looking for guys who can operate when they take the uniform off, they still can operate as normal people.
Yeah, and you brought up a term of art. So a lot of folks listening to this, if they're not in the community, there's all sorts of different ints, you know, SIGINT, ELINT, COMINT, but signals intelligence is kind of what you were talking about. I mean, I think I go back to Murph. You know, we're talking about, again, Adam will neither confirm nor deny, but we'll talk about what's known. But Centrospike was exactly that. It was signals intelligence. I mean, these guys were wizards at pulling shit out of the air that nobody else could get to and helping you guys understand plans, intentions, things like that of what Pablo, Spock, you know, shocker, spoiler, he's dead. But, you know, what the organization was doing, because it was all at that point with the radio telephones, a lot of it, right, was all about communications. What were they saying? What were they doing?
Right. Right. Now you hit it on the head, hit the nail on the head there. Excuse me. And one thing I was looking at here while you're talking about the unit is you had somewhat of a high ranking individual that kind of kept you guys motivated, that actually went out on ops with you or whatever you call them, missions, details, General Stanley McChrystal, right?
Yeah, so I'll go back to what Morgan was saying. I'm not confirming or denying anything Morgan said. between you guys. So I'm not discussing
except
that.
The fact that you're good looking, 6'7" and good looking. You won't deny that, right?
You know what? Actually, let me confirm that.
Okay.
But let's go to my crystal, actually, as I am in Iraq. So one good thing for us, for our unit, we are like chameleons. We can be going out with Delta. We can be going out with SEAL Team 6. We can be going out on our own. We have more capability than just signal intelligence. We have other capabilities. We had our own, we had a lot of guys, our former Rangers, former Green Beret. We had guys actually were former SEALs and former Delta. So our unit was really diverse to that point where people coming from other SMOOs, from other special mission units. So I was in Iraq, and it was my first night in Iraq. And we're going out with Delta. And we were in search for Saddam Hussein. We were like the task force main thing was to.
And you were part of the unit at that time, right?
Correct. I was part of the unit. It was my second deployment in the unit.
Did you ever know a guy named Kevin? Did you ever know a guy named Kevin Holland? We had Kevin on, former SEAL team, Special Mission Unit Delta. We had, I can't remember what episode he was, Murph, somewhere around 60 or 70 or something. Yeah, but we had, funny you mentioned that, because we had Kevin on talking about the mission to get Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, so I was in, I was out with the team, and that was our first night there. And I'm like, here's this kid from Egypt, now in a special mission unit in Iraq with the best task force on the planet, part of the best unit on the planet. So we're going out in those armored Panthers. So you go in, it's dark, all the missions were at night. This older guy comes and sits next to me. My team sergeant at that time was with me as well. So he and I went out on that mission. This older guy sitting next to me, he's chatting with me. Then we go out to, I think we hit at least 6 or 7 houses that night. And obviously all of them, there was no Saddam in any of them. But as we go into some of these places and this guy standing chatting with me and I'm like talking to him, I'm like, you know, this old sergeant major standing just chatting with me. And my supervisor pulls me aside and he's like, hey, man, you might want to be careful how you addressing that guy. He's a general. I'm like, no fucking way. And he's like, he's a general. And I'm like, dude, don't say that. And I'm like, I'm embarrassed now. And we go, we do the whole missions. We come back. And they do a hot wash, AR, after the mission. So McChrystal goes to the front and he takes his body armor off. And at that time, he was still 1 star, about to be 2 star to be the JSOC commander. I was humbled. I'm like, you know, here is a general officer going out with us in hits at 2 o'clock in the morning. And most likely he's going to be sitting in a briefing in about 5-6 hours. So it was an eye opener for me how JSOC operates. And It set the pace for me to like, okay, you know, this is how this community work and operate. In the future, I had guys who were who became the SEAL team commanders. They were out with me in missions, again doing stuff like that. And we carrying our bags and our equipment, and this guy who's an O6 colonel helping us carrying stuff. The same thing, not just from the SEAL, even from our organization. And one of those guys is a 4-star general now. I'm not going to say who he is or what position he's in, but he's one of the highest positions in the Army. But he used to carry our bags with us and help us out. And that's how JSOC was, and that's how JSOC is, and that's what made them. I think that's what's making them one of the best forces in the world.
It gives you so much respect for your leader to get out there and actually lead, you know, and after I read your book about that part and what he was doing, it gave me a greater respect for that man. But also Kevin Hollow is episode 70. So for our listeners, if you haven't listened to Kevin's story yet, go take a listen to it. It's excellent.
Yeah. Well, it was easy to find Kevin in the backwoods of North Carolina because he was the guy walking around carrying a huge log. So we figured that out. That's how he was training. But for you, Adam, if I were to see a platoon of guys standing out there, you know, would I know, you know, just as an Army guy, would I know that some of you were like, as they say on Sesame Street, one of these things is not like the other. Was there anything about the way you equipped, you dressed, that set you apart when you were in uniform from other folks, or was it just totally indistinguishable?
Totally indistinguishable, and I'll tell you why. If we are out with Delta, we are dressed exactly like them. If we are out with the SEALs, I mean, we, again, the JSOC community, they dressed the same. We had the same weapons. We had the same capability of buying equipment. We had a decent amount of fund to buy what we need. But if you see me in an airport in, let's say, Heathrow, you will think I'm just a very gray guy who's traveling, like either a businessman or the good thing, like I told you, we were chameleons. If we needed to travel as a businessman, then we looked like businessmen. We were all fit because you're still in the army. You still have to do the army fitness tests. You still have to do your military schools. There is still an army standard that you have to follow. But you're not going to see me with a high and tight haircut. You might see me with facial hair. You might not see me with facial. It depends on the situation. But you will not be able to tell who we are. No, I don't think you'll. And so far, that's why so far I'm the first guy who was an operative to write a book. So far, people don't know us, and we like to keep it that way.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.